We are fortunate this morning in having as our speaker one of the great dynamic leaders of the church. Brother Richards has devoted over 50 years of service to his church in positions of major responsibility. He is the third apostle in direct family descent. His father was President George F. Richards of the Council of the Twelve, the head of the council. His grandfather, Franklin D. Richards, was also a member of the council and a nephew of Willard Richards, pioneer leader, apostle, and counselor to President Brigham Young. His mother was Alice A. Robinson. He was born in Farmington, Utah, then moved to Tooele, where he grew up on a farm, attended the Tooele schools, and finished his education at the Salt Lake Business College. His church service began when he was called as a missionary to the Netherlands from 1905 to 8. Other callings have included a branch president at Portland, Oregon, Netherlands Mission President, Sugar House Ward Bishop, Granite Stake High Council, then a mission to the Eastern States, Liberty Stake High Council, Glendale, California Ward Bishop, Hollywood Stake President, Southern States Mission President, University Ward Bishop, and then in 1938 he was appointed presiding bishop of the church, in which position he was active until 1952 when he was called to the apostleship. He's the author of two very widely read books in the church. He has always had a peculiar desire to meet with young people. And we are most happy that within the last month he has been named a member of the Executive Committee of the Board of Trustees of this university. Brother Richards, we're happy to hear from you at this time.
After all that, I just want to tell you that I'm just a grown-up deacon, you know. Don't expect much from me. Well, I love the church. I love the Lord. I love this institution. I commend President Wilkinson and all of his associates and the faculty for their great work here. And I love you young people. And I've been in the home of the parents of many of you. And so I'm grateful for the privilege of being here, but I feel terribly weak when I look here and see this crowd. And then I read in the newspaper that you had Brother Brown here last Sunday night, and he's the great orator of the church. Incidentally, I had a meeting with him at 7:30 this morning, and I said, I wish there'd been a month between our visits instead of a few days, because then maybe they wouldn't have been comparing me with you when I get down there at the Why? But I feel to thank the Lord for this institution. I don't know where you young people could go in all the world and find a group like this. And you come out of the finest homes of the church everywhere. And I'm old enough to be your grandfather, most of you. And so I'd like to talk to you a little this morning about your being here. Especially those of you who are here for the first year. I think of 27 years ago when I was down in Atlanta, Georgia, president of the mission down there, and we let one of our sons come west to go to college. And you know, he wasn't quite as old as his daddy. I used to tell the bishops if the Lord had wanted old heads on the children and the young people, he'd have put them there, but he didn't. So it's up to us older folks to try and help to train them. And so the night before he left for the West, we sat up till about 2 o'clock in the morning. We went over everything together. I tried to tell him what I could about the experiences of my life and what I knew that I didn't think he knew. And then as we parted, we stood with each other in our arms, and I said, "Now, my boy," I said, "you know how your daddy was raised." I said, "you know what my father expected of me. He used to tell us boys that he would rather lay us away on the hillside clean than to know that we'd lost our virtue or robbed a woman of hers. Now I said, my son, that goes for you too. And we looked each other in the eye, and he says, Daddy, I don't think you need to worry. Now that was worth more to me than if somebody had handed me a check for $1 million. And I haven't had to worry about him. He filled his mission, and he's served for years on the general board of the MIA, and now he's one of the coordinators for the missionary work in 6 of the stakes of Zion. I tell you, it's wonderful when we can keep our feet planted in the right direction. Now, no doubt your parents talked with you before you left home to come to this institution. I hope you won't forget the counsel and the advice that they gave to you. They've made great sacrifices, many of them. Oh, there are a few rich parents, but there, a lot of the parents have gone without nearly everything and would do just to give you young people the privileges that you enjoy here in this institution. Now, I don't know whether they sat up with you till 2 o'clock in the morning to tell you what you ought to do and how you ought to live, but if they didn't, you know what they have in their hearts. Now, I hope you'll all be successful in the battle of life, but I hope that you'll also remember what you owe to your parents to not let them down. It'd be a wonderful thing if every one of these young men and young women here this morning could live the standards of this church in such a way that you'll prepare yourselves for the great opportunities of leadership that awaits you in the church. That's why we maintain this institution, not just for academic training. That's important in the world in which we live today, because it's difficult to climb into positions of responsibility in the world without a college training these days. But above all of that is to have the testimony of the gospel. So I thank this great body of the faculty here for what they're doing and for their influence and for their faith. I don't know whether how many of them were here when we held the special session when Brother McDonald was officially initiated as the president of this institution. And Brother Albert E. Bowen, a member of the 12, gave the address and the charge to President McDonald. One thing he said that I haven't forgotten, and I think I will never forget, he told about how many professors he'd studied under in the West and in the East, but he said, there's one man who stands out in my life to whom I'm more grateful than any other man, and he said that was one of my professors who planted into my heart in the days of my youth a desire to make something of myself. Now you see, that after all is one of the greatest things in this world. You remember the little statement that goes like this. I know you all know it. It says, to every man there openeth a way and ways and a way. And some souls climb the highway and some grope the low. And in between on the misty flat, the rest drift to and fro. But to every man there openeth a highway and a low. And every man decideth the way his soul shall go. Each one of us have to make the decisions day by day that will mark our future. And we never do a thing without we have to get permission from ourselves to do it, whether it's good or whether it's bad. And so we are the architects of our own fate. You remember the little statement, I think, by Longfellow, where he said, lives of great men all remind us that we can make our lives sublime and departing leave behind us footprints in the sands of time. I read that and memorized it at the request of President Grant when he was president of the European mission and I was on my first mission over in Holland. And you know, that did something to me. I read about Edison that got up at 4 o'clock in the morning to pursue his studies and his efforts to give to the world what he has given. What did I do? I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning because they put me in the mission office and I didn't like it a bit. I wanted to get out and preach the gospel. The Lord had to give me a special dream to make me happy to stay in that mission office. And so I'd get up 4 o'clock in the morning so I could study the Dutch language and get my office work done. You know, lives of great men all remind us. Why don't you pick out somebody you'd like to be like? Of course, we can't all be just like the Savior. We can try and follow in His footsteps. But we see around us men who've overcome their difficulties and their handicaps and have arisen to positions of honor and responsibility. And those of them who are members of this church, nearly all of them have achieved their greatest success by remaining true to the church. Now, maybe this wouldn't be appropriate here, but you've read a lot about George Romney lately. I picked up Life magazine last night, and there's his picture again, and they're now more or less prognosticating that he'll win the election back there as the governor of that state. And if he does that, being a Mormon boy and a state that hasn't gone Republican for 13 years, there'll only be one reason, and that is that he has the manhood and the determination and the courage that other men don't have. Now, I've happened to know George ever since he was a boy, and when he was courting his wife, she was a personal friend of my oldest daughter, and George was in our home often, and his father was my bishop, and he worked for me, and I've been in George's home, so I know him pretty well. I'd like to just tell you a little bit about George Romney to show you that what lives of great men can do to inspire us if we have the desire to make something of ourselves. The high road, the low road, in between on the misty flat, the rest drift to and fro. Well, after George had filled his mission and married, he went back to Washington to get a legal education. And, of course, he had to work to help keep that little wifey of his. You know how that goes. Well, anyway, he heard that one of the senators there, and I know who he was, needed a secretary. So George went and applied. And the man at the desk said, "Oh, there's no need of your applying. We already have," I think he said, 24 applications. And he said, "Before the senator gets to you, he will have hired his secretary." George said, "I want to be the 25th. Now, I'm not right positive of the numbers, but that's the way I remember the story. Well, the senator went through the whole list, and when he came to George, George walked up to the senator and he said, "Senator, I'm a Mormon boy from Utah. That's the best recommendation. It's getting so down in California. That's the best recommendation a man can have to get a good job down there, is to find out that he's a good Mormon boy. I was back here in Oklahoma the other day to select a state president. And he was has a very prominent position there in one of the schools. And one of the questions they asked him when they invited him back for interview, 'Are you a Mormon?' 'Yes, sir.' 'Are you a good Mormon?' 'Yes, sir.' 'Well, we already knew that, or else we wouldn't have invited you to come,' he said." So George walks up to the senator and he says, "Senator, I'm a Mormon boy from Utah. I've filled a mission for the Mormon church. I don't use liquor or tobacco or chase women. And I'd like to be and I belong to the opposite political party to what you do, but I'd like to be your secretary." The senator was just floored. He looked at him and he said, "Well, go in there and hang up your hat and go to work," he said. That's all there was to it, you see. Well, now, a short time after that, a representative of one of the great institutions of America, and I know the company, was in this senator's office. He said, "I wish I knew where I could get a public relations man, some upstanding, fine young fellow, to represent our company in the halls of Congress." The senator says, sitting right in there at that desk, says, "I don't like to let him go, but I wouldn't like to stand his way." Now, if I have the story correct, they gave George $10,000 when money was money to start in with, and a nice automobile to drive, and a nice house to live in. But George never once had to lower his standards. He was first and foremost a Mormon boy from Utah. And when they wanted to hire him to be the vice president of American Motors, he said, "My family comes first. My church comes second. If you want third, call on my time, you can have it." And they hired him and took the third place.
But first was the, and then when the announcement was made in the newspaper, George insisted that they should give prominence to the fact that he was the district president for the Mormon church in that locality. Don't you admire somebody like that? He didn't have to lower his standards and in order to be able to get to that position. Well, now you see where he is today. Of course, now I just give you that as one little illustration. I could give you a lot of illustrations. I talked about my son and how I instructed him and how we parted with the promise from him that I wouldn't need to worry about him. And then I compared that with when I left my home out in the little country town to come into Salt Lake to go to school. And one of the boys who was a member of my deacon's quorum, and I was his president, came with me, and we boarded together. And when Saturday night had come, he wanted to go uptown and see the sights, and I was always too busy to go with him. I had lessons I had to get. That was my way of keeping out of trouble. Well, he went to see the sights. Every man chooses his course in life. You know that. There are the high road and the low road, but he couldn't keep up on the high road. I've had that boy come in my office many times after he became a man and a married man to ask for a dollar to buy bread to feed his family because he started drinking and lost his manhood and his power to produce for his family. I was walking along the street in Salt Lake and met a man who used to live in the ward when I was the bishop. And he had a beautiful voice to sang at the funerals, and he had been a member of the Sunday school superintendency. And there he was, he looked like a vagabond. And I said, it goes hard with you calling him by name, doesn't it? He said, I made my first mistake when I took my first glass of beer. He lost his wife, he lost his beautiful girls, they were beautiful singers, his son's a doctor, and there he died just almost an outcast. I tell you, there's a high road and there's a low road, but we can't take any chances on getting down on the low road. Now, I have a little thought I want to leave with you here today. While I was the presiding bishop of the church, we used to have the young ladies give talks in our conferences on the subject of the kind of a woman I'd like to be. And then, of course, we had the boys give talks too. But one of the girls wrote this talk, and I'm giving to you, and we published it in the Improvement Era. And a minister wrote from back east, I think it was in Virginia, and asked permission to publish it in leaflet form. He said, I want every woman and every woman's daughter in my parish to get a copy of that. I didn't very long. I'm going to read it to you. And then I want you girls to keep this in mind. After you've heard this, why don't you take time out of your busy lives and write down the kind of a woman you'd like to be? And then why don't you read it over every few weeks and see if you're veering off of the path that will make you the kind of a woman you ought to be. You remember the old saying that sin is a monster of such evil mien that to be pitied needs but to be seen. But seen too oft, familiar becomes her face. We first pity and then endure and then embrace. We don't become wicked all at once, and we don't become righteous all at once. It's a process in our lives. So if each of you girls would write a little essay on the kind of a woman you'd like to be, and then read it over about every 30 days to see if you're on the straight and narrow, it might do you a lot of good. And then on the other hand, why don't you boys write something on the kind of a man you'd like to be and what you'd like to achieve in life and accomplish and what influence you'd like to wield among your associates right on this campus and from there on up as long as the Lord gives you the right to live. And then why don't you read it over every 30 days or so and see how near you're keeping on the straight and the narrow. Well, now here's the little article on the kind of a woman I want to be. I want to be the kind... I know what you're thinking. I want to be the kind of woman people are proud to be seen with. A person people can get along with. You'd be surprised how many they can. I want to be the kind of woman others can trust and confide in without fear of anyone knowing of their little secrets or grievances, one whom people can consult for help, advice, or spiritual aid, one who can comfort the sick and the grieving. I want to be the kind of a woman children like, one to whom they will show their new toy, new dress, or new shoes, one who is interested enough in them to listen to boasts about some wonderful thing they have accomplished. I want to be the kind of a woman my friends will appreciate. I want my parents to be proud of me when they say, "This young lady is our daughter." As I go through the church, I get a thrill listening to the parents boast about their young people who are here, been here, the things they're doing and their influence in the world. Isn't it marvelous when parents can live to see the fruits of their labors and their teachings when their kiddies don't let them down? I want to be the type of woman men will be proud to date, knowing that they can have a lot of fun that is good and clean and honest. Wouldn't it be wonderful, Brother Ballard used to say, we could just help our young people over Fool's Hill. Now, you'd be surprised how many people don't get over Fool's Hill. They stumble along the way. If they could just take those few years of courtship and keep themselves sweet and clean, and when they're out with the opposite sex, if they could live in the clouds and air castles, building what you want to achieve in your lives instead of groveling down in the muck and the mire like some young people do, I want to tell you, they'd reap great dividends from it. The Apostle Paul said, "Be ye not deceived, O vain man, for whatsoever ye sow, that shall ye also reap." And if you travel the low road, you're going to reap the results of it. And if you travel a high road, you're going to get the remunerations and the dividends that come from that. I'm repeating this last sentence. It's a good one. I want to be the type of woman men will be proud to date, knowing that they can have a lot of fun that is good and clean and honest. At the side of every successful man, there generally stands a good woman, the type of woman who encourages him to attain higher goals, who applauds him when he is up, and comforts and gives him that little pat on the back when he is down. I want to be the kind of woman who will be able to manage her home and family successfully, beautifully, and prayerfully. I want to be a woman who is beautiful inside. That's a very important thing. One who is God-fearing. One who gets the most out of life. I want to progress spiritually, mentally, and physically. I want to be a strong pillar in the church, an ideal wife, and a perfect mother. That's the kind of woman I want to be. Now, you don't get that without living for it any more than you can get a crop of wheat without planting it or corn without planting it. That you sow, that shall you also reap. Now, you think about that a little, and maybe you'd like to write a little article and see how near you can live to it. Now, I have another little article here for you men. This is a mother writes to a young man about his courtship and attention to her daughter. And then every time you take a girl out, you just ask yourself, now, would that woman, the mother of that girl, be proud to trust her to me for this evening, knowing that I'd defend her with my life if it were necessary in order to return her to her home or her room the way the mother would like her to come? Well, I'm going to read you this. And this is the mother talking to the boy. "You're a fine chap who takes my daughter out quite regularly, and both she and I like you a great deal. Our feelings for you are very different, naturally. She thinks of you as a good friend and one with whom she has gay, interesting evenings. You call for her, and she dresses in her most attractive clothes and joins you merrily to depart for a show, dance, or perhaps a party. I stay home and think about you, and my feelings about you are those of partnership. I am trusting to you the most precious thing I own. Perhaps that sounds sentimental, but it's true, For years I guarded the tiny person she used to be, fed her the right food, put her to bed for a long night's rest, watched her teeth and temperature and general health, and for what? Now just remember what the mothers have done for these girls you're going to take out. I tried to watch her mental health and the health of the spirit within her as well. I tried to teach her to be fair, honest, and strong, to regard herself as valuable, something not to be neglected nor thrown away carelessly. I don't know how well I succeeded. You'll know far better than I. She'll tell you things she won't tell me. Just as I said things to her father, I couldn't have said to my mother. She is something like a gardenia to me. The flowers so overwhelmingly white and sweet, and I am letting you borrow that flower for a while. All I ask of you is that you keep it in cool, fresh, clean air, that it might come back to me fresh and sweet and white. If you have ever seen a gardenia brown and withered, shriveled around the edges of the petals, you'll know what I mean. Take care of her for me. I'm trusting you, lad. Now, I think there's some good thoughts in that, that if you boys will realize that every girl here comes with the love of their parents. They pray for them every day. They've raised them from childhood and given their lives to make them what they are. They're sacrificing, many of them, to permit them to come to this great institution. And may God grant that no one of you will ever be responsible for having the gardenia trusted in your hands go brown on the edges. Have you ever seen a gardenia? If you have, you'll know what this woman's talking about. They're a beautiful flower, but they're very tender, and you can't soil them. Now, I tell you, brothers and sisters, that this is a great opportunity that your parents have placed in your hands, and I have every confidence in our young people. As I go through the church and interview them for missions and otherwise, I thank God for the institutions of this church and for the teachings of the parents and for their influence in the lives of our young people. And then we are sort of trouble department, and we have quite a lot of people come to us in their troubles. And you wish that you didn't only have the power to suggest that they could overcome their sins and start over again, but that you could blot them out of their memory. I'd like to tell you a little story. I've told it in church a few times. When I was a boy, one of our brethren out in the ward that I lived in the country came to church one night, and he had with him a big 2x12 plank about that long and a sack of 10-penny nails and a hammer. And right in our presence, he drove all those nails in that 2x12 plank. And then he pulled them all out one by one. He said, "You see, they were there, but they aren't there anymore. But the holes are there." And then he preached a sermon on the holes, and I've never forgotten it. It was a power to me in my youth. He told how hard it was to get rid of the holes when we had them in our lives. Now, since you're a lot of them aren't married, I'm going to tell you another little thing he said that night. If my wife were here, I wouldn't dare say it because she doesn't like it, but she's at the Relief Society conference, so I can say what I want. You don't know how we men have to march around at the order of our wives. And I sat in a meeting with the first presidency and the presiding bishopric when I was the bishop and won the presidency. Said, "Now, if you men will admit it, every one of you take orders from your wives," and there wasn't one of us that denied it. Now, this is what I wanted to tell you. That same man that told us about that plank, and there isn't time for me to go into detail on it because it's time to close in just 2 or 3 minutes. He said this. He was trying to teach us young people how to live. He told us that we hadn't ought to be kissing girls until we were sure we were going to marry them. And then he used this little illustration. He said, "Which one of you boys would like to eat a sandwich where your boyfriend had licked all the butter off?" And you know... That made such an impression upon me as a boy that I decided that no boyfriend of mine had ever accused me of licking the butter off of his sandwich for him. And I kept my promise. Now I can walk the highways and I can go in any city in this church, and I'm not afraid of meeting some old gray-haired woman that I want to walk around on the other side of the street. And when I go out in the town where I was raised as a boy and I try to tell them how they ought to raise their boys and their girls, I'm not afraid of seeing two old women down in the corner rubbing their heads together and say, "Yeah, but you'd ought to have known him when I knew him as a boy." All I'm trying to tell you is, don't have any holes. You just keep them out, and then you won't have to worry about them. Now, with all my heart and soul, I say, God bless you all. I love you. I'd do anything in the world to help our young people. And I thank the Lord for them and for your faith and for your integrity. And I just hope I live long enough to see some of you whom I know personally arise to positions of honor and responsibility. And if you do, you'll be largely indebted to your parents and this great institution. And God help you to do it, that you may walk the highway and not in between, nor down on the low. And I pray and leave you my blessing in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.